How do I sound?
You sound beautiful.
Sound effervescent.
Effervescent. Oh,
what does that mean?
Bubbly and...
It's a word Dusty would butcher.
Yeah.
Effervescent.
Let me tell you something, baby.
So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
And I had just come from seeing Tina Turner, my girlfriend, and Mel Gibson in the Thunderdome, right? And I see this cage, and I see this top on the cage. And I know through the years in my industry, the cage match has always been a big part, especially down south, when you blew off matches. And so I said, has there ever been two rings with a cage, one cage covering both rings with the top on it and two doors at each end and two teams of five? And I've got the okay from Jimmy Crockett and Crockett Promotions. He's standing right over there. So you can build this thing. He said, well, where does it go? I said, it's going to hang above the ring and it's going to drop down. He thought I was completely nuts. I had just watched a hockey game also where the guy went through the penalty box. So they were uneven. But I reversed it and started out uneven. So the rules were simple, man. You know, two guys started 5 minutes, the coin flipped, next guy came in. Then when all 10 guys were in there, 10 members, that's when it started. That's the match beyond began. Submit or surrender. And I remember one of the negatives were, well, it's going to take out a bunch of front row seats. And my promoter's always thinking about the money. My deal is just charge them. The ones you took out, charge the rest of the people more money. It don't matter. They're going to come see this.
We don't need another hero. We don't need to know the way home. All we want is what we got.
Looking for something.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of Review Away. Why is it so special beyond just my voice that you're hearing? Well, we are joined by Wei Ting and a third member. The third man is Nate Milton, returning to Review Away. Nate, how are you?
What is going on, brothers? I am happy to be here, hopping out of the time stream, coming back to the present from the year 2000, as it were. And I don't know, you said returning to Review Away, John, and maybe we'll have to get the fact checkers on this, but I believe this is my first formal appearance on the mothership.
No, I meant just returning from the space-time continuum, the abyss you went into the last time I thought you were going to be joining me on Review of Raw. I was talking about you returning just period to life. We were very concerned about you that night.
I am here. I am living. I am breathing. But unfortunately, this week, as we'll get to, John, I went from one abyss to another abyss in terms of one of the matches we'll talk about this week. But yeah, man, it's great to be here as always with you and Brother Tang. And I feel like I've missed this camaraderie.
That is true. And you contacted us when you, of all the things we reviewed, it was War Games that really struck a chord with you that led to you reaching out to us to volunteer your services to come watch these matches with us. What was it about War Games that certainly, is it a nostalgia? Yeah, tell us about your own opinion of War Games and its return coming up in a few weeks.
For me, John, what it was is I was extremely excited when I heard you and Wei announce what you were going to be reviewing on the next edition of Review Away. The second thing is I know kind of where you lie in terms of your feelings on the concept of War Games and the execution of War Games. And I figured War Games need an advocate, somebody to speak on its behalf. And the third thing was I had a few adult drinks and I was feeling pretty good. And you know, you get bolder.
This was a drunken email to us then.
I texted John, like, hey, you up? And he didn't reply, but I was like, hey, when you wake up, you know, let's you and me team up on this War Games thing and call Wei and we can have a three-way dance, if you will.
Well, for the record, I never got a text from you. So some random person out there probably was asked about war games late at night and was probably very concerned given the state of the world of who was sending this message.
I'm not going to touch that because I don't want you guys to get the Review America feedback that myself and Brother Man got. But real quick, touching back on your question about why war games, I think it's three things for me. One is the nostalgia factor, obviously. You know, things look better with the passage of time. And, you know, we look back with those rose-colored glasses. And I think Great American Bash 89 was the first time I remember seeing War Games. And that still is one of my favorite shows ever. And I really like the concept. And that's the second part of why I really dig War Games is it's just a unique design and the aesthetic of the two rings with the big cage over the top and the dramatic, some would say over dramatic lowering of the cage with the fireworks and all that. It's just a good spectacle for me. And then the third thing, I guess, John, away would be when it's done right, which is not always the case with war games. Like when it's done right, I think it's a very effective match and it's a very effective storytelling tool. When you've got the right people in there and the right story to go with it. So those would be the three reasons why I really have always been a fan of the concept, at least, of war games. And I'm interested to see what they do with it in an NXT setting.
And Wei, you made the choices of what we were going to review today, and it kind of runs the gamut. We're going to see all versions of war games, the good and the bad, throughout this. How many war games matches had you seen prior to this? I guess we've done that Fall Brawl from 98, so you've seen that one. But is this a gimmick match that holds much nostalgia value for yourself?
No, not at all. I actually don't remember us ever doing that Fall Brawl 98 review.
I could be wrong. It could just be PTSD or something.
I know we've also done the Wrestle, what is it?
We did do the Bash from 89.
We did the 92 one too, didn't we?
Probably.
Yeah, we
it's
probably
a blur
done a
at
few.
This point. I don't remember at all.
So we've done a few, but like, no, I never grew up with, I did watch a WCW on like TBS from time to time, but I never really saw the pay-per-views. And so, I certainly don't feel like I ever saw War Games in its heyday, you know, back with the Horsemen or anything like that, unlike Nate. So I'm really curious to get Nate's perspective. But my perspective is more of like, I think it's a really interesting concept, but I never felt like I got a good grasp of it at its best. And that's why I wanted to watch all these matches before we watched it. And we see it in the WWE. But best, of course, balanced with perhaps the worst. So it's important that we get a good slice of what it can be, all the potential that it has, and all the potential that it has for disaster as well.
Yeah, and I think, Nate, you can really break it down to the fans that grew up with this match, where this was the big blow-off match in the late 80s. If you lived through those matches, I can totally see how you hold this match in such high regard. I think if you only are – your reference point is the mid to late 90s in WCW, it's a completely different viewing that you might hold in your mind of this match.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, if you look at those matches from the mid to late 80s, maybe up through the 92 edition of War Games with the Dangerous Alliance versus Sting Squadron, like you've got some really good matches, some really good performers. I think Meltzer looks back at a lot of those matches in high regard, particularly the 91 match that we're going to talk about. But once you get into, and it's no coincidence that the decline in War Games correlates to the decline in overall WCW booking. And so the more crazier and convoluted WCW gets, the less impactful War Games seems to be. And for those that are a little bit younger and didn't grow up with the War Games, I can see how you could think it's more of a hokey gimmick than the be-all, end-all of a feud, which it was originally intended to be. But when they took care of it, when they protected the gimmick, when they protected the spectacle of this match, it worked and it connected. And you can see in these matches that we're going to talk about, particularly the first couple of matches, the crowd is invested and they're living and dying on every entrant and every period that goes through. But if you don't take care of it and you don't respect your own stipulations and your own matches and your own creations, then it's hard for the fans to take them seriously too. And that's what I think happened with the later editions of War Games.
Yeah, so the way this format is going to work for today's show, we have picked the four War Games matches, and we're just going to go match by match, reviewing, sharing our thoughts on each one. And we're going to start off with the Great American Bash Tour of 1987, where there were three shows spread out over the month of July, and the first one was July the 4th at the Omni in Atlanta. And this was the first time they had introduced the War Games concept, which was a Dusty Rhodes idea that came out of the Mad Max movie. And I guess at this time, Nate, were you following the NWA in 1987? I mean, what was kind of your viewing at this point, if any at all?
I was marginally following the NWA. I would have been about 10 years old at the time, 9 or 10 at the time. So I didn't really get deep into my wrestling fandom until a couple years later. I'd say like late 88, early 89 was kind of my awakening when the scales fell from my eyes in terms of wrestling. But I remember like going to church and people talking about the Road Warriors and Dusty and the Horsemen and this concept and things of that nature down here. And so I was aware of the War Games and I was aware of the key players, but I wasn't as big as a fan as I would eventually grow into.
Wade, did you ever go to church and have pro wrestling discussion?
I mean, I've never been to church, really, period.
Okay.
So no, I can't say I have.
Well, 13,500 fans on July the 4th treated the Omni as though they were going to a religious experience because this crowd was so unbelievably hot. Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone are calling this match, and you can barely hear these two as the audience is reacting to everything. Like this wild brawl, you had 10 individuals in this match who this crowd, as Nate said earlier, they were living and dying through these personalities, and it was just an unbelievable atmosphere. They could get away with doing half of what they did, and it was still this unbelievable atmosphere for a match that was just, you can watch this match alone just for the crowd heat, and I think you'd walk away with such a memorable impression of this match, regardless of the work inside of it.
Just a note before we continue, John, for people who haven't seen the matches yet, we're referencing the versions that are available on the WWE Network under the War Games collection where you guys can all follow along. But in particular for this match, though, this one happens to be Joint in Progress, at least on their site. It also contains like a bit of a weird audio mix where Schiavone and JR are kind of like, I don't know what exactly happened, but there's something kind of weird about their mix. You can find a proper version of this if you Google, and a full version does exist on Daily Motion.
Yeah, it's so it's Joined in Progress on the network version. And to set this up, we have the Four Horsemen taking on the team of Dusty Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, the Road Warriors, and Paul Ellering, with J.J. Dillon joining the Horsemen in this match as well. And I think everyone's familiar with the concept. Two men begin for a 5-minute period, and then every 2 minutes, a new entrant enters based off the coin toss, which most times it would be the heels getting the advantage, but eventually people got too clever for their audience and thought, huh, what if the heels lost the coin toss? Anyway, this one did make sense, though. So it starts off, and Arn and Tully are beating on Dusty Rhodes. That's where this begins, and the heat is just out of this world. They're attacking the left leg of Dusty, applying the figure four. Fourth entrant in is Road Warrior Animal, as this crowd just leaps off their seats. Just at a man entering the match, the advertised participant entering said match gets the most incredible reaction, that here he is coming to help Dusty Rhodes against these two heels that have the numbers advantage. And you can try and keep track of all the guys that do blood in this match. Dusty was the first after Blanchard rams him into the cage. Ric Flair enters in next, going after Animal. And then Arn joins Flair to double team Animal. They're beating down Dusty. The blood is flowing through his hair. Nikita Koloff enters next, and he does a big power display, knocking down Flair and Arn as the place explodes. Blanchard and Flair then run face first into the cage, and Flair hits these repeated chops, the Koloff no-sells. Flair just runs. He's begging for mercy. He is vintage Ric Flair in 1987, selling for the big baby faces here. Then Lex Luger, who was part of the Horsemen at this time, he is next in, power slams Koloff. Flair hits a low blow to Koloff. There's a spike pile driver delivered to Koloff, and Dusty tries to shield him. Dusty puts himself on top of a fallen Nikita Koloff to protect him like he's a child here that has been attacked. And from there, we had Road Warrior Hawk enter. Jim Ross is just losing his mind, calling this a history-making event. And then the final entrants are J.J. Dillon on the Horseman's end, with Hawk no-selling all of Dillon's offense. And then we have Paul Ellering in. So before we go into the match beyond, Wei, first off, just your impressions of this time period, which I've been critical of with Lethal Lockdowns and prior War Games matches, is that there's no way the match can finish here. That didn't matter at all to this audience. They were so into the violence and the fact that they were seeing all of their favorite stars having this just bloodbath here in the War Games. How did you feel this set up the match beyond portion?
I thought it was amazing just to watch this crowd react. And I mean, it's interesting to think about how the NXT match will fare with that audience, because I think so much of it depends on how much of an audience cares to see their baby faces get beaten down. And I mean, in 87, this was a time where people just couldn't stand seeing Dusty Rhodes getting tag team 2-on-1 by Tully and Arn. And that was enough to get a huge reaction out of him. So, that it was incredible. And I think that, you know, other things that really stood out to me were just seeing the whole two cage setup, two ring setup, which, to my knowledge, I don't know if people have attempted two rings side by side prior to this, but it's really interesting because I think, you know, the War Games in itself, if it happened only in a single cage, I don't think people would look at it as such a big deal. The fact that it's two cages creates that visual spectacle. Plus, it allows guys more free space to run ropes and cut others off. And, once everybody's in there, things get really chaotic. So that extra space really helps.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, you know, just the visual appeal of it. And, you know, when I was a kid, one of the things I vividly remember as I was preparing for this week's episode is I remember creating little wrestling promotions with my action figures back in the day. And I only had a couple actual wrestling figures. I had Sting, Flair, Hogan, and Ron Simmons. And then I had to fill out the rest of the roster with He-Man figures and G.I. Joes. And I used to take like two box tops and make my War Game setup. And so even as a kid, just the idea that there were two rings and you could actually have a guy jump from one ring to the other. And you always had this kind of weird in between space where the rings connect and you've got ropes on each side and like this little narrow walkway. I just like the visual of that. I think the other thing that stood out to me just going back and watching this was we kind of forget how good some of these performers were. Like I shouldn't have been surprised because I know Lex Luger was doing good work around this time period, but I was surprised by how good Lex Luger looked to me at this time, even though he was still fairly young in his career. Nikita Koloff surprised me. And then I guess the other thing that really surprised me, and maybe this is because I'm looking back on this match with 2017 sensibilities, is I don't know about you guys, but I was a little bit taken aback by the blood. And I know that's one of the complaints with modern day cage matches, particularly in the WWE, that we don't get that blood. And I don't know, like after watching these War Games matches, I get that it definitely makes it more visceral and makes it more impactful. But there was a point in these first two matches, particularly, where I was just kind of, I got to a point where I was, no pun intended, oversaturated with the blood.
Yeah, it's such a common trait when you had these cage matches to have blood. But I would argue in this match, if you had not done blood, I don't think this audience would have been any less into this match. I mean, it's kind of expected that you have it with these cage matches. There's no doubt that blood can add something. but it's not everything. It's not, it cannot take two characters that no one cares about and suddenly inject an arena to be at the edge of their seats over. This match, just the brawling nature of it, like this audience was watching this wild, out of control brawl with characters that were so over that they were all behind. And I mean, the blood was something, but you're right. And especially 1987 NWA, there was an over reliance I found on blood. It just became the fact that this is what we do. And you could go up and down a card on a major event. And it was just, you're right, it lost its significance because it was not saved for the main event. It was all over the place. As we go to the match beyond, this is where it's now submission or surrender to win the match. And
real quick, John, and yep. Wayne, like, did you, and this was another thing that got me as a kid, like up until the point where we have all the competitors, it's just war game, but it's everybody in the ring. It becomes the match beyond. Like, I know it seems hokey now looking back on it, but that always got me that as a kid, that hooked me. Like, this is something different than what we've been watching previous to everybody being a participant.
Yeah, my next note here was just all of the blood on all of the participants. And Paul Ellering is using this spike on J.J. Dillon to open him up. And might I say, Paul Ellering fucking jacked here as the manager of the Road Warriors getting involved in here. I mean, this guy, I mean, if you didn't know any better, you'd assume he was another wrestler off the roster.
Yeah, he definitely looked more fitting for the role than J.J. Dillon, who I thought was an interesting choice here as the final man. It makes sense, though, because when you think about it from a psychological perspective, you wouldn't want J.J. in there. You would want J.J. to have the least amount of ring time because you know that he's not going to do any damage. You know he's also susceptible to the pinfall, which we'll obviously see at the end of the match. So you want to kind of keep him there, keep him as fresh as possible, and keep him out of trouble as much as you can. So it makes
sense. Maximize, you know, the want to see the babyfaces finally get their hands on J.J. Dillon. You don't want to give them that at the beginning of the match. So yeah, it was laid out very, very well. The Warriors lawn darted Dillon into the cage twice, and then Animal goes to lift him for the doomsday device, but instead of getting him up in an electric chair position, he holds him up in this side slam setup, and they continue with the move, and then J.J. Dillon lands awful on his right arm, and on the following week's television, they show this in the most painfully slow motion replay of his arm just coming closer and closer and the angle of his arm widening, and he just shattered his shoulder from this spot, and to the point that he was scheduled for the next War Games match and had to be taken out of it because he legitimately messed up his shoulder here. And the Warriors stomped on Dillon until he surrendered by the end of the cage, and he just laid on the mat bloody, and the Superpowers win the match with J.J. Dillon submitting. This was an unbelievable spectacle, and it instantly, to me, got the War Games concept over because this was something unlike this audience had seen up until this point in the NWA.
Absolutely. It's very much the same concept as an NBA or a Major League Baseball All-Star game. Like, you put your best guys in this match, you let them go out there and have this wild, crazy, violent fight, and at the end of the day, you give the fans what they want, which is the bad guys getting their comeuppance and the winning the day. And I thought, you know, it was so well executed. And I think there's a reason why, you know, this concept, when done right, can be super effective in terms of telling a story.
Yeah, to add on to Nate's sports analogy, like, what I took from it was that the concept of a War Games is very much like a penalty box in hockey, where anytime you have an extra man advantage, whether it be from a penalty or from, you know, you pulling the goalie, it creates that incredible tension of that one extra person being on the ice and giving that other team the advantage, right? And the moment that countdown clock runs down and the penalty is over and your teammate comes out to help save the day, it just creates that incredible reaction. And I think that's something Dusty really hit on with this idea. He must have been so proud to be in this match, to see the crowd reaction as this match was unfolding. Cause I mean, everything worked perfectly. You know, the psychology is that when it's a fair fight, the good guys are clearly the better athletes. They're the better team. The only way the villains can win is if they have the man advantage. And it just, every countdown to that advantage ending for the heels creates this great anticipation, and every new entrant is essentially a hot tag, just like in a tag team match where the guy comes in, clears house until the heels get the advantage again. So it worked out really well, and this crowd was just the perfect guinea pigs for it.
It's almost like a distilled version of a Royal Rumble, you know, with the countdown and the fact that, yes, you have a limited amount of guys, but you don't really know which guy is the next man in. And so there's this anticipation, like, is it going to be Road Warrior Hawk? Is it going to be Animal? Is it Nikita? And that's just something that is such an easy, simple thing, but it definitely works.
Yeah. And to go against my own point I've made before about kind of that first getting all the participants in this match and in the other ones, where for the majority of what we're going to talk about today, the match beyond portion is like 2 minutes in this match. So it puts the emphasis on all of what preceded it, that these guys have already been through hell for 20 minutes and the match only lasts about 2 minutes because everyone's dead at the end here and someone is going to submit. It's not as though they're going for another 10 or 15 minutes. And I think that small window of time at the end actually benefits the match. It places so much more emphasis on everything that happens before it.
Yeah.
So this was excellent.
It was really good. Like, it's interesting that the WWE, you know, never really tried to replicate their own version of this. And I try to wonder why that is, obviously because I think it's a gimmick that's so tied to the NWA and WCW. But when you think about it, they kind of have their own thing that's similar to this in the Survivor Series, which is almost like a reverse War Games, where instead of increasing the evenness, you start off at a disadvantage, but then you increase the number of participants until you get full teams. The Survivor Series is the opposite, where you start off with full teams and you increase the advantages as the match progresses. So that could be a part of the reason why they never wanted to do War Games. So I'm all the more interested to see how WWE handles the gimmick, especially with the three-team format, which I don't know if it's the best type of
I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And granted, I watched the worst version of it here, but I just just the two teams, it works so much better when there's a real heated issue. And I mean, we'll get into it later with the 98 one of why I don't like that format. But this one as well, I mean, it's worth noting, like, for the WWE to do this concept on a pay-per-view, I mean, WWE live event tickets for a pay-per-view, especially floor seats, to kill off X amount of those seats, it's costly to your gate just to fit in that second ring. And I'm sure there's kind of a hesitancy just to do that. Is what value is there in doing this other gimmick that, I mean, it does affect just those seats that you can sell. And it could be something as simple as that they're kind of adverse to doing, whereas an NXT show at this particular time period for NXT, where I don't know if they could fill the Toyota Center, I think you can experiment with stuff like this.
Production wise too, John, it's like it's a whole different animal when you have two different rings. That's two lighting rigs that you need. That's two hard
for the whole show.
Two different hard cameras that you need to center one for each ring, as you'll see later on. You know, that's the way WCW did it. But yeah, it's like I'm sure it's just at some point it was probably too much of a headache for them to decide to ever do, which makes this again all the more interesting that they're even attempting it.
Yeah, and I mean, another idea too is that if this becomes a regular thing for NXT, or even if the WWE dabbles into it, given their Mattel deal, there is a ton of merchandising towards this. I mean, for the young Nate Milton out there booking his He-Man characters to sell a War Games setup for kids, I think that there's certainly money to be made with this concept if they really run with it. I mean, look what they got out of the Shark Cage last year.
Yeah, that would be my counter. You know, I'm on the same page with you, because I think there's a way to make the War Games profitable and offset whatever production costs you'd incur and whatever money would be lost from the floor seats. I think there's a way to really integrate this into your lexicon, your universe, as it were. Like, if we can get, I don't know if this is the best example because I don't really know how over the Punjabi prison match really is, but if we can get that over to whatever extent, I think they could do War Games if they execute it properly and that would be one of, you know, one of the more intriguing things that they would have in terms of being able to market it.
So we're now going to go to the second War Games match. So at this time, the Great American Bash, this is not a pay-per-view. This is something that, outside of highlights that they would have shown on TV, if this got around with word of mouth, that was about it until the VHS release. Or, I mean, there was no way to see this match unless you were there live, which, given the buzz of this first match, I think it helps for the Orange Bowl show, which is July the 31st in Miami. And they explained it on TV with J.J. Dillon's injury. In to replace him would be the War Machine, the masked Ray Traylor, later to become the Big Boss Man. So he would be taking J.J. Dillon's spot in this match, joining Ric Flair, Lex Luger, Arn Anderson, and Tully Blanchard to take on Dusty Rhodes, the Road Warriors, Nikita Koloff, and Paul Ellering. And in this match, this clearly seemed like it was done in studio afterwards, with Tony Schiavone calling this match solo.
Mm-hmm.
So the match begins with Dusty Rhodes and Arn Anderson going through the 5-minute period, and Arn is run into the cage bleeding immediately, and then his face is rubbed into the cage, which is still one of those great spots of a heel getting his face rubbed into the steel cage. Crowd was very loud here. It even sounded overmodulated on tape as Dusty applies a figure four to Arn, and Schiavone is explaining the match cannot end yet, no matter what. And then we get the coin toss, and surprise, surprise, the heels win, and they send in the War Machine for the next 2 minutes, and they double-team Dusty, who started bleeding. War Machine lands on the left leg of Dusty off the turnbuckle, and then Dusty fights back with elbows as the bell sounds, and Road Warrior Hawk comes in to even things out. Ric Flair is in after that, and he joins in with Arn to attack Hawk with chops and hits him with a low blow. Then Nikita Koloff enters, another insane roar, as he takes a pile driver from Arn and stands right back up. This was the spot usually associated with Road Warrior Hawk, no selling a pile driver, and Nikita just stood right up. Rhodes is in the corner dropping shots onto Flair as Koloff is doing the same to Arn. Tully makes it 4-on-3, and Dusty scoop slams the War Machine, and this was all just transitional stuff, and the crowd was still at a fever pitch throughout this. Then Road Warrior Animal joins, and at one point it sounded like these airplanes flew over top of the stadium. And then Animal swings Blanchard by the legs over his head repeatedly into the fence to bust him open, which was the best busting open of a heel of any of these War Games. Anderson and Animal then go into the cage, Flair with a low blow. Lex Luger is the final entrant for the Horsemen. Paul Ellering is in last for the Babyfaces. And then we go into the match beyond, which, just like the last match, goes about 2 minutes. And Paul Ellering has a spiked wristband that Schiavone identifies, and he starts using it on Flair, but then he's chopped. Animal murders War Machine with a wild lariat, and then Animal and Hawk follow with the same, and then Koloff takes him down. Animal takes the spiked wristband and starts rubbing it onto the eye of War Machine, slams it down onto his face, and the bell rings to end the match as the War Machine has basically been mutilated here by the hands of Road Warrior Animal and this demon spiked wristband, and the superpowers win yet again. Another pretty heated match that I would put just under the first match. This was still a really incredible spectacle. But for me, maybe it was watching it back to back that I still thought the first one kind of set the tone.
Yeah, I thought this was a solid match, but I think the loss of Dillon hurt the match a bit. You know, nothing against Boss Man, but there isn't that connection that you had with seeing J.J. Dillon get beat down. So I thought the match was good. It's funny because, you know, you talk about one of your complaints coming into this job, the amount of time it takes till we get to the match beyond. But with these first two matches, to me, it's all felt necessary. You know, it hadn't just been this thing, which we'll see with later War Games matches, where guys seem to just kind of be going through the motions. Like, these dudes are coming in here and they're being physical. They're coming up with creative spots, and there's intensity. And so I think in that way, the setup, or the bulk of the match leading up to the Match Beyond, it actually works and enhances things as opposed to just kind of being this Milhouse on The Simpsons, when are we getting to the fireworks factory type of thing that you're just sitting through.
Yeah, I agree with Nate. I think intensity is really the main ingredient that you really require for a match like this. I'm with you guys. I didn't think this was as good as the first one. It was still, you know, very entertaining, but I thought it's particularly the last few moments of this were less exciting than the last match. And I didn't feel the heat as strong for those last moments. And I wonder how much of it is due to maybe the audience is catching on that nothing really is settled until, you know, all the participants come in. But even then, I just didn't think War Machine here, Boss Man, really looked all that great. And the finish here with that spiked wristband, come on. A spiked wristband? Please. Not a very dramatic conclusion. But still, you recognize that it's a very interesting concept. But I definitely think it takes the right level of talent, a gang that, like the Horsemen, and an opponent like Dusty, and an audience that reacts as well, for I think everything to work.
So after this show, I mean, they really went all out with this match. They did another War Games 2 weeks later in Chicago. Then they did one in November of 87. And then, I mean, I'm just looking at the list here. There is a period in July of 88 where they did the War Games July 2nd, 12th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 21st, 23rd, 24th, 28th.
Wow.
How many of those did I just list up? They did those nonstop in, man. Like, man, they really, but granted, I mean, they were going market to market, taking this match everywhere, which was probably a lot on the guys to try and keep the level up most nights. And I'm sure there were War Games that were better than others in this. I don't know how great the Johnson City, Tennessee one may hold up, but
it's a lot on the ring crew as well.
Oh, it's a ton. But man, this was their calling card for this Great American Bash tour that they would take. So they had plenty of these, and we're going to skip now all the way to February 24th, 1991, and it is Wrestle War. And at this time in WCW, this is when Jim Herd was running WCW, and it is also when Dusty Rhodes had just returned to the company as Booker after leaving for his time in the WWF, then leaving there. He was briefly in Florida, and now he was back in WCW booking all of this. And on top of that, he would be calling this match alongside Jim Ross. So this took place in Phoenix, Arizona. And this one would feature the Four Horsemen contingent of Ric Flair, Sid Vicious, and Barry Windham. And Arn Anderson was replaced by Larry Zbysko because Arn Anderson had suffered this groin injury and he wasn't able to come back yet. And this led to this awesome line where Ross and Dusty are explaining the replacement, and Dusty says, it doesn't really make much sense why Larry is replacing Arn Anderson, and I'm just thinking, Dusty's the one who booked this fucking thing. he's poking holes in his own damn booking. And they would be taking on Sting, Flyin' Brian, with no G, and the Steiner Brothers, and this really was the Brian Pillman show. The night before on TV, they did a big attack on Pillman with Flair coming off the turnbuckle to his shoulder, which would be all taped up for the match. And Brian Pillman would endure one of the most horrendous looking power bombs in this match. And so that's our setup for this one.
Also, and, John, this unlike the previous two matches, we get to see here a lot of fanfare surrounding the lowering of the cage.
And missing the ring, too, as it came down.
It landed a bit crooked. But they did get it down. But, you know, this was something that we didn't obviously see in obviously the outdoor stadium, nor in the first one. But, you know, Nate, do either of you guys kind of remember when that actually first became a thing, a lowering of the cage? Because even, like, cage matches at the time weren't necessarily lowered from the ceiling with fireworks like this.
I'm thinking maybe 89 at the earliest, but I'd have to go back and check that one out. But yeah, it definitely is something that after this match in particular, we see it going forward, just the kind of pomp and circumstance and kind of insanity of we're going to lower this cage extremely slowly and have fireworks and sparklers shooting off the side of this cage. to get this thing over. But I vividly remember this match, and I vividly when John sent me the list of war games that we were going to review, this one was the one that stood out for good reasons, and there was another one that stood out for completely different reasons. But I remember just being so invested. This might have been close to the peak of my NWA / WCW fandom. And, you know, we'll talk about Flying Brian here in a second, but he certainly was one of my favorites, maybe even above that man called Sting.
Yes, and this would be when Pillman was in very good standing in WCW, because shortly after a few regimes down, when Bill Watts came in, that's when, because Pillman had just gotten this big raise at the time and was pretty much relegated, saying you either take a pay cut or you're going to be doing jobs and opening matches. And he just replied stating, well, I'll be the highest paid jobber in the history of this industry then. So this was a very different time period in early 91 where this match was totally built around Pillman and shining as the babyface, much bigger than Sting was almost a background figure in this match. It was all about Pillman here. And also just look at the Horsemen contingent. Nate, what did you think of this version of the Horsemen, which included Sid at the time? And this was after Barry Windham had replaced Lex Luger's spot in the Horsemen.
It's kind of a wash, and no disrespect to Brother Udy, but this is like you lose Luger, but you gain Windham. I think that's a big win. But then you add Sid, and we'll definitely talk about Sid as this match progresses. But this iteration of the Horsemen was interesting, because it felt to me at the time that they were kind of trying to phase out the older guys. Much like when Arn came in, you know, Ole was kind of pushed to the side. And so I like this iteration of the Horsemen. It's interesting. It's not my favorite by a long stretch, but it's certainly better than the Paul Roma version of the Four Horsemen.
Yeah, and this was before WCW was going to go through some big changes, because Sid would be finishing up at the next pay-per-view, and not saying that was a deal breaker for this company. But then the bigger one was Ric Flair taking off later on this summer after his whole fallout with Jim Herd. So this was kind of setting up for what would be a big facelift for WCW, losing two key guys that were in this match. So the match begins where everyone is out, and as the babyfaces are strategizing on who is going to start, Flying Brian flies into the cage, and Sting has this look of concern, yelling, "Brian, you're hurt!" And Brian, the fearless babyface, dives into the ring to go after Barry Windham against the wishes of his team, and starts attacking Windham. So he goes the whole gamut of this match, including incorporating hanging onto the ceiling of the cage to execute moves, including a head scissors. So Pillman was using some unique offense in this cage.
It was cool. Did you mention, John, like why Pillman was injured?
Yeah, it was the injury angle from the night prior they had done with the Horsemen attacking him. And you'll also notice that Ric Flair had his quad all taped up. And I was looking into this, and I don't think it was a quad injury he had per se, but a few weeks prior, he had suffered something like second or even third degree burns on himself when he went to a McDonald's and a coffee fell on top of him.
Wow.
So
wow.
So he was the original.
Had Nature Boy had the foresight, he could have been even more prolific with his wheeling and dealing if he had taken him to court.
Well, I don't know if either of you have seen that documentary about the woman who sued McDonald's for the coffee being too hot that fell on her. But I mean, it was always a joke that someone sued McDonald's because the coffee was hot. And then as a result, they have to put the warning on the coffee cup, that warning, hot. And you watch this documentary and the burns that this elderly lady suffered are horrifying to look at. So Ric Flair, I think his McDonald's incident may have predated hers, if I'm not mistaken. So anyway, I'm pretty sure that's why his leg was wrapped in this particular match. So during this first period, Wyndham's face gets run into the fence and starts getting busted open. And Wyndham bled a ton in this match with, I believe it was Jim Ross saying, "Ooh, headache time as Pillman starts headbutting Wyndham. And Wyndham just bumps all over the place for Pillman. He really did a great job. He's begging off. He's got the full crimson mask before the first 5 minutes is up. And these first 5 minutes, Nate, were just all Pillman.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the babyface fire that we saw from Flying Brian. Like, this is a dude, I think people forget how athletic and how good he was in the ring at this time. Like, I remember him coming out with the Cincinnati Bengals trunks, and I think Def Leppard Rocket was his theme song at the time. And it's just, he had some really great matches with Lex Luger that people forget about. But in this match, I love the story that they were telling. Like, from the beginning, you talked about when he ran into the ring, you know, it hooked me. And I just thought the intensity that he showed and some of the creative spots using the cage and, flying and using those elements were really cool. The only thing that disturbed me was there was a point where Wyndham busted open and Pillman does the "I'm gonna gnaw on your forehead" spot, and then he comes back and he's got all this blood around his mouth, and it's just like, I didn't need to see that.
Well, that would be that may be a later incarnation of Brian Pillman. You would expect a spot like that rather than the flying version of Brian Pillman. So they do the coin toss, the Horsemen win, and Ric Flair enters and starts attacking Pillman. They do this crazy chop exchange, and then Wyndham lawn darts Pillman and his shoulder into the cage, and they're double teaming Pillman, working over the shoulder until Sting enters to even the numbers, and they're doing the countdown from 10 for the audience to get excited, and the camera is inside the ring, so you don't know who's going to enter. So there is some drama here of the countdown, but at about the count of 7, Dusty just says to everyone, "Oh, it's Sting. Sting's ready to come in." It's like, Jesus Christ. This guy's like, I don't know. The guy who came up with the match really was just throwing a wet blanket on any kind of drama about the surprise factor of this match. So Sting enters and fires up on Flair. Larry Zbyszko enters next and makes it 3-on-2. And I don't want to say Larry Zbyszko is a complete non-factor in this match, but he may as well have been. I mean, he, to me, brought less to this match than the War Machine in the 1987 version that we just chatted about. Sting dove into the second ring with a shoulder tackle to Zbyszko, showing a lot more vertical ability than he would several years later. And Flair then breaks up Pillman's figure four on Wyndham. The next entrant is Rick Steiner, and Flair and Wyndham immediately go after him, but are hit with clotheslines. Flair is run into the cage, face gets rubbed against it, and Flair is busted open. Sid Vicious is the final Horseman member in. He holds up Steiner, Rick Steiner, for Flair to hit low, and then Zbyszko full on rams Rick's head into the cage, and Rick doesn't sell a goddamn thing from this. Flair is selling like a maniac for Sting, and the countdown is on, and the final entrant is Scott Steiner, who is literally being held by the waist by Nick Patrick until the countdown is over. This animal just will not stay put on the floor until the count is up. So Nick Patrick had to subdue Scott Steiner. So now we go into the match beyond. Scott hits a tiger bomb to Larry Zbyszko, which is probably one of the most dangerous spots Larry took in his life. And then we get a close-up of Sid and Rick Steiner going over their next spot in the match. A classic WCW production moment. Sting applies the deathlock to Ric Flair. Sid then tears off the tape from Pillman's shoulder. All the baby faces apply figure fours simultaneously to the heels, including Pillman applying one on Sid, which I guess we could see as a precursor to their interaction later on that year, which would involve a squeegee. And then Sting military presses Rick into the top of the cage ceiling. There's this crazy chop exchange with Flair and Pillman again. Scott messed up this DDT to Wyndham, and Ross just covered, saying Wyndham was trying to block it. And then life stood still for everyone in this arena, because Sid deadlifts Pillman up, and you can see the cage is so low that Pillman's head is going into the ceiling, and Sid just fucking drops this guy on his neck. And clearly Sid gets down on his hands and knees to ask Brian if he's okay, and Sid figured, well, Let's try that again. So he lifts him up, hits a much cleaner power bomb, but Pillman was legitimately knocked out in this match and would actually miss time after this match from this power bomb. So Pillman is just lifeless here in the ring when El Gigante runs down the ring to check on his little buddy, Pillman, and he rips off the cage door 6 years before Kane would, and El Gigante, who has nothing to do with this match, waves it off, and the match is over as he tends to Pillman, and he carries Brian Pillman a la Hulk Hogan with Miss Elizabeth on Saturday night's main event, and El Gigante takes Flying Brian to the back, and that is how the match ends. Way, what did you think about, first off, the match and how it held up to prior War Games matches, and then your thoughts on the finish?
I thought this was outstanding. The best of the War Games matches maybe I've ever seen. It had a really great story throughout. You know, Brian Pillman, just this underdog who just wouldn't give up, and he spent the most time in there, had an injury, and then, like, at the end, he took a legitimately crazy bump that I felt justified the ending of the match. Yeah, it looked awful, but, like, storyline-wise, it was kind of perfect because he couldn't continue, and I think it needed something that looked that visually awful for you to really justify the match ending. I thought JR was just amazing here, especially with his treatment of Brian Pillman, putting him over as just like the smallest guy on the team, but the guy with the biggest heart. He went nuts. He went crazy when Pillman was dropped on his head, and I don't think this match would have been what it was without him. I just thought it was like a really heated match with great teams and held together by, I think, Brian Pillman, who really, you know, was used very effectively in his role.
Easily the star of the match was Brian Pillman. Nate, how did this one hold up for you in comparison to the other ones we've discussed?
Definitely my favorite so far. And I think the story has more to do with it than anything, because the first two that we watched, they were great. But, you know, I felt from the story, not having as much familiarity with those characters, even though, you know, I know about the Road Warriors and Nikita and all those dudes, but this was my jam. Like, late 80s, early 90s WCW, that's my wheelhouse. And so, you know, just seeing these guys and remembering how athletic Pillman was and Sting, you know, maybe at his physical peak, you know, doing that dive from one ring to the other, that's an image I still remember clearly to this day. And then you got JR, who is such a great storyteller, particularly at this time. And I always loved when JR had a guy with legitimate football history to go into on his commentary, because, you know, Brian Pillman, he was cut off his high school team, but he was a walk-on at college, and he was on the Cincinnati Bengals, but they cut him, but he won the Courage Award, by God. Like, just the way that he brings you in to get behind this guy. And I really enjoyed the storytelling in this match. And then, you know, we get to the finish, which I remembered, of course, but I'd forgotten how bad that bump looked in real time. And it's like, oh, like it did kind of work out in their favor, because it did tie back into the story, and you had El Gigante coming out here doing maybe the greatest thing El Gigante's ever done in WCW. And then he carries Pillman out. You know, you said Hogan and Elizabeth, John. To me, as a comic fan, not just a wrestling fan, it brought back the memory of the iconic DC Comics cover where Superman is holding a dead Supergirl, spoiler alert, on the Crisis on Infinite Earths. Just that pose with the concern in El Gigante's face. And so I really like this match. I thought, you know, good on WCW or whoever was in the back to have the presence of mind to, you know, make this finish on the fly. I thought everybody worked hard. Even Zbyszko, you know, he took the Tiger Bomb, so you got to give the legend that one.
So was this an unplanned finish?
No, I mean, I had never heard it was any different, because, I mean, El Gigante's run-in was, that was supposed to be how the match ended. And I think I don't want to say lucked into, but it was a match that if that happened today, the match probably would have been ended if Pillman was was there and legitimately knocked out. I don't think that – I think he was just supposed to be in storyline knocked out from a safe power bomb. Mm. So I think it just was a weird coincidence. And, yeah, I kind of echo your sentiments as well. I thought Pillman was tremendous here. And in losing, I think it did more for him than had he even won the match pinning any of these guys. And Dave Meltzer was actually live in attendance at this show. And just a quick blurb from his write-up on this was, suffice to say, this is one of the best matches I've ever seen live. 22 minutes of solid mayhem with the crowd on its feet, screaming from the opening of the action. This was supposed to be Pillman's night, since the object of this match was to get Pillman over and at the same time have him lose and carried out of the ring. On the surface, trying to accomplish both seemed mutually exclusive, but it seemed to have been successful, and gave this a 5-star rating in 1991 and says, this result is definitely an affront to anyone who believes you have to send the fans home happy on every big show. But the predictable finish, Zbyszko submitting, did not take place. On TV, the downside was that on one occasion you could hear Sid Vicious and Rick Steiner setting up a spot.
His
only complaint.
How many 5-star matches is Sid involved in?
Oh, this would have to be the only one of his life.
Oh, that's
the
incredible.
Only. You're right. That's quite the stat there of Sid Vicious and his 1 5-star match.
Damn! Wow.
Well, and War Games would get 5 stars for the following years, which some view as the best one ever, involving the Dangerous Alliance at the 92 show. So that is also one certainly worth going out of your way to see. You want to know one which got the another pretty rare rating? That was -4 stars. We are now going to be going over to September the 13th of 1998,
yes.
WCW Fall Brawl, and the consensus, I would say, worst War Games of all time. Although, as we got into the mid-90s, there were some candidates. First of all, this one was a break from the 2 teams. Instead, we had 3 teams of 3, and the winner of the fall would get a WCW title shot at Bill Goldberg for Halloween Havoc the following month. Now, my question to either of you is, what was the point of teams in this? Because we had guys attacking teammates and everyone was going for a title shot. It may as well have been every man for himself. I didn't understand the team concept in this at all.
It was a fucking mess. It was a fucking mess of a match. And it's rather unfortunate going from watching the previous matches that we did straight to this, because this almost didn't feel like War Games. Or if it was War Games, it looked like War Games, but it didn't seem to carry on any of the things that worked about the previous matches. So I could only imagine that Dusty had nothing to do with this one, because if he was, it'd be like, I mean, it's, he must have felt so sad watching this. You know, it's like seeing like your child being abused.
There's a difference, a big difference between knowing what something is and knowing how to execute that thing. Like I know what freestyle rapping is. I know about the cipher. You know, I'm no DJ Jopo, but I know about that world. But if you put me in there against Eminem or J. Cole or Wale, anybody like that, I'm gonna look like an idiot because I don't have the skill set to excel in that. Now with this, yes, you know what War Games is, but whoever is doing this, they don't have the idea or the experience to execute. They don't know what makes War Games great, and going to the 3 teams and making it essentially every man for themselves and making it where the fall can happen at any time instead of just waiting for the match beyond. To me, those are elements that essentially undermine even having a War Games match in the first place.
This match was so shit, it completely blew my argument out of the water that I've said about the opening period, I mean, where there's no finish. I mean, I watched this, I'm like, okay, there's a reason for it. That's how bad some of this was. And I don't know how you stack up all of these examples of how you couldn't figure something can go wrong here. When the words trapdoor, dry ice, and Stevie Ray are all part of this, I mean, at what point do you just put your hands in the air and say, all right, guys, this is not great. This is not a great plan that we have for this Fall Brawl War Games. And the teams consisted of our Wolfpack team of Kevin Nash, Sting, and the returning Lex Luger. taking on the NWO Hollywood version of Hollywood Hogan, Bret Hart, and Stevie Ray. And then we had Team WCW, Diamond Dallas Page, Roddy Piper, and Warrior. Now, I'm going to ask both of you to guess who the youngest member of this match was, starting with you, Wei. What's your guess? Who was the most, who was the fountain of youth in this War Games match?
Yeah, kind of tough here because Bret, Hogan, DDP, Roddy, Warrior, they're all kind of up there. And then who's in the Wolfpack? Sting, Nash?
Luger and Nash.
Oh, my God. Wow. I'm going to have to guess Stevie Ray.
Nate? That's kind of where I was going, but I'm gonna go with, you know what? Give me Kevin Nash. I'll go with Nash.
All right. Everyone, with the exception of two men in this match, are 40 or over. There were two men that were 39 years old, so I really had to do some math here and go by the month. Sting, born in March of 1959, was 39, but the youngin' of the crew was Kevin Nash, born in July. July of 1959.
Brian Pillman blue chipper of this match.
Oh, my Kevin God. Nash. The range. You know what was crazy? Warrior was only 40 at this point.
Wow.
He was younger than Bret Hart. And Stevie Ray was 40. That one surprised me because I looked at these names. I was like, my God, this is like the stereotypical WCW main event match. And I figured Stevie Ray has to be late 30s and was surprised to find out he was already 40 in 98. Hogan would have been the oldest at 45, DDP 42, Piper 44. I mean, my God, this was the age in the cage, which was anyway. So Michael Buffer introduces this match. The cage lowers and they explain the stipulation. The winner of the fall gets a WCW title shot next month at Halloween Havoc. And then Diamond Dallas Page.
Okay, hold on, John. Before we get into the match proper, you know, Brian and I on Keep It, not Keep It 2000. Yes, Keep It 2000. I'm getting my shows mixed up. But on Keep It 2000, yeah, we have the highlight, the bright spot of the week. And I think even in this debacle of a match, there were some bright spots, John Pollock, and most of them occurred most of them occurred before the match began. So when I started this match, we get a panning shot of the crowd, and the first voice that I hear is the late great Bobby the Brain Heenan. Tony, that woman's got no teeth. And then Tony Schiavone replies, "Don't be mean, Brain, but she's got no teeth." So that was amazing. You talked about them explaining the rules to this War Games, John Pollock. They didn't just explain the rules. We had graphics on the screen.
Yes. Nine rules to explain this match, which is literally not the hardest match to describe. And they made it sound like fucking advanced calculus to figure out what the fuck was about to happen. These nine rules.
I know. It's like, this is something also that I'm curious to see what the WWE will do, because I would assume that their production staff wouldn't be going this route of having somebody read basically a novel before the match begins about what the rules are for this thing. So they're going to have to be really creative explaining, you know, how this match takes place. The best way to do it, obviously, is visual. But War Games is a little complicated, you know what I mean? You kind of have to – it's kind of like a board game. You just kind of have to learn it through playing it. And I'm curious to see what the WWE does.
Ooh, that's another marketing tool, Brother Ting. Oh. If the WWE goes full force with this War Games concept, we could have War Games the board game. Come on.
It's definitely an easier match to explain, though, than the King of the Mountain match.
Yeah.
Can we agree on that?
Yes.
Than many of Bruce's
literal penalty box. Anyway, so this is still when WCW is, even though creatively they are really hitting a wall at this time period, they were red hot at this time in 1998. I mean, it was a full year and a half before the full-on collapse occurred, but still really healthy audience, 11,528 here. They had a $218,780 gate in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So out comes Diamond Dallas Page to no music, and Bret Hart to start.
No, they come out to the same repetitive, ominous theme music that they lowered the cage to. They play this for everybody.
Yes. Yep. Which kind of just killed the audience even popping for the entrances, which, I mean, that was such a – and unlike other war games, you didn't have the teams at ringside. You had them coming from the back instead. So you figure 5 minutes of DDP and Bret Hart in 1998 that would be, you know, a solid two guys to start with. I mean, it's slim pickings when you're looking at these nine candidates. Very underwhelming 5 minutes. Very standard, a fraction of the heat of any of the prior war games we're talking about. Bret attacks the back of Paige. And again, they explain the finish can occur before anyone else enters the match, which to me just made this stupid. I totally hated this idea. So I will not complain any longer about the fall not occurring until everyone is in the ring, because this to me just diminished everything. It was almost like you were just playing your audience for fools, that you were going to see Bret just roll up DDP before anybody even gets into the ring. Third entrant was Stevie Ray. And the highlight of this entire period was Paige hitting a double clothesline. The fourth entrant was Sting, which helped me assure that my speakers weren't broken on my laptop, so the audience actually made noise when Sting came out to assure us there were people in this building. And this is where he attempted his dive from one ring to the next, and I mean, that's one thing when you're 33. It's quite another when Sting was 39 here doing this, because he barely got over, but to his credit, did get into the second ring and splashed Stevie Ray. Roddy Piper followed him in, and he went after Paige and Bret, which
his teammate,
again, his teammate, Diamond Dallas Page. And the announcers make no big deal out of this. And I'm wondering, you know what? Is it illogical? Like, why do we have teams? It's not as though the team gets anything for winning this. It's only the individual that gets the fall. So teams are completely irrelevant in this match.
So much of what made the last matches work were because you had those teams where one team was at a disadvantage and a teammate would come in and save them. That's war games. That's the whole concept behind this shit. Instead, it's like you're just turning this thing into a Royal Rumble at this point.
And I mean, if you want to really, I don't even know if this is that much of a nitpick. When I'm watching Paige and Roddy Piper go at it here, like, why wouldn't Stevie Ray just give himself up to Hogan to get pinned?
You're right. 100%. That made no sense.
That's Stevie Ray's role in this match, is that he's not winning this. He's just there to help Hogan. Why didn't he just lay down for the guy? And it's like you've introduced, like, there's no team unity here. So why not? Why doesn't Stevie just lie down for Hogan to give him his title shot? It took you right out of this match. And it was just peak WCW, where the holes were just so big to try and overlook. Lex Luger was out next. Shivani suggests that maybe we're going to see members turn on one another, proving that Shivani isn't even fucking watching this match. Heenan then yells, "It's every man for himself." So we have contradictory rules here. Piper applied a sleeper hold onto Stevie Ray as the countdown began. Kevin Nash comes out to pyro and a big reaction. I mean, you can't deny in 1998, Nate, the popularity of the Wolfpack was pretty strong at this point.
Yes, the group in and of itself, if you actually take a look at what the Wolfpack is, it doesn't make sense from a storyline perspective. Like, I still bristle at the fact that Sting joined the Wolfpack. It makes no sense. But, yeah, Sting, Nash, even Luger to a certain extent. Like, you heard the ovation when they came out, but the sad thing to me was, particularly with Sting, like, he got this big ovation, and it died down pretty much as soon as he got in the ring, just because there's nothing of consequence here.
Yeah, and Kevin Nash did a great job of playing Houdini in this match, where he just, outside of a leg drop he took from Hogan, like, he was anonymous in this match. Like, he was just not involved really at all. He
disappeared in the mist, in the trap door, probably.
I guess so, yes, but he was not missed. So he comes in, he goes after his good friend, Roddy Piper, famous for their locker room brawl of a year and a half earlier. Luger applies the torture rack to Bret when Hogan just comes down to the ring and just enters the match before the countdown is up. He just enters for early. So, okay.
Yeah, cool. What was this?
Yeah.
I have no idea if a cue was like, it made no storyline sense. I didn't know what was going on here, and the announcers didn't seem to have any explanation either. Hogan just entered this when there was 90 seconds left on the clock. So he's part of the match.
Yeah, and he's got a slapjack.
A slapjack where he just attacks everybody. Stevie low blows Bret Hart, and he
his
even calls...
His teammate, by the way.
His fucking teammate, Bret Hart. Heenan calls it good teamwork between Hogan and Stevie as they are literally defining that.
That's crazy because until you mention that, guys, and I just rewatched this match before we started recording today, I forgot during the course of this match that Bret Hart was on NWO Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they had been doing like these teases of issues with Hogan over the summer, and it was just – it was such awful use of Bret Hart throughout this whole point, because by this point in 98, it had almost been a year he'd been here in this company, and he realized they're really not going to do anything with this guy. He was such a non-factor in WCW at this point. Hogan does the leg drop to Nash. Crowd was pretty hot at this point. They were chanting Hogan sucks, and then the dry ice filled the ring and we got the return of the Renegade, who you may remember dressed up as the Ultimate Warrior inside of the ring, and they start beating him down when more smoke fills the ring and Hogan is left with Warrior's coat. So the Warrior has evaporated from his jacket into that same goo which Papa Shango drew out of him. Then Pyro goes off, and the actual Ultimate Warrior runs from the back to attack Hogan and Stevie Ray.
So let's dissect that.
Do your best.
If you're the Warrior, what is the mindset behind that little bit of voodoo trickery? You vanish, you vaporize into the ring to surprise your opponent, and then you disappear only to come out from the back where they can clearly see you coming and they can anticipate you? How does that make sense?
Mind games.
Not mind games. Not the greatest strategy in the world. Yeah, I'm watching this. I'm like, okay. So we've got the literal smoke and mirrors going down here, and then you get the Renegade.
This was the smoke. The mirrors would come after this when Hogan could see Warrior's reflection and we couldn't.
Beautiful. But there's like, at what point did the Warrior, like, I want to get into this. Let's deconstruct this. When did Warrior have the time to set aside the Renegade and you know, hatch this plot, which is, as Way said, completely asinine, because why, you know, what advantage did you gain from this? What advantage did you gain from the charade?
Imagine the Ultimate Warrior character going over this plot with the Renegade. Imagine these two sitting down at Starbucks after the Warrior contacted him for this idea he had and how he would sell this on him.
I'm imagining it, yeah.
So anyway, this was horrendous. This also nearly, in a roundabout way, nearly ended the career of Davey Boy Smith Jr. and could have done a lot worse. Because
this was it.
To set up this whole idea or this whole plan was to have the Renegade come up from under the ring through a trap door. Wow. So they set up this trap door, but they never told the talent on the show to avoid this trap door. So earlier in the show, Davey Boy Smith takes a bump on this door, contracts staph infection, and he is hospitalized. And it's not an extension to say near death at one point in 1999. From this staph infection, and then was fired by WCW.
Oh my God.
So this was not only stupid, it was also reckless.
Yeah.
Yikes.
War games. So Hogan then slides out of the cage with our good pal, the Disciple, on the floor, who just told Hogan, let's be quick.
And that's the other thing. Like, no repercussions at all for somebody physically just entering and coming into the cage. Like, the referees weren't doing anything. You're allowed to leave this War Games match.
So Hogan leaves the cage, and then the officials padlock the door. So this was just come as you feel up until this point when they realized, wait, someone can get out of here. So they padlock the door. Warrior then does his best Brian Pillman impression by grabbing the roof and kicking through the cage fence and gets through this. This might have been the most athletic thing I've ever seen the Ultimate Warrior do, and attacks Hogan and the Disciple in the aisle as security has to separate them and both leave. And then instantly we cut back and DDP lands a diamond cutter on Stevie Ray and pins him to the most nothing reaction you've ever seen of a guy getting a championship title match. This was awful. 20 minutes and 6 seconds of the worst War Games match you're going to see.
It was a mess. Like, what can I say? It almost seemed like they were going for that negative 5-star rating.
They failed with that too. They only got 4.
It's like, it's not enough that you change all the concepts that I think were what made the previous War Games successful. The dual teams, the intervals, and just the respect for the rules in general. But then to lay on over top of it with all this bullshit, with the mist and the vanishing and the trap doors and Hogan coming and going as he pleases, it just unfortunately doesn't really get my hopes up for the 3-way War Games in NXT. I'd much prefer a 5-on-5, but I think I trust Triple H and I trust the talent in NXT to hopefully do it justice.
Nate, any closing thoughts on this particular War Games and how this company could put together this match and 24 hours later, you got one of the greatest segments in Nitro history with Ric Flair's return?
Yeah, this was abysmal. I don't know if you guys are fans of America's Next Top Model, but this reminded me of that great scene where Tyra Banks is angry with one of the competitors. And she's like, you know, we were rooting for you. We were all rooting for you. I was rooting for you and you let us down. And then that's how I felt about this. Like, you know, I'm going to come on here and talk to John and Wei and tell them about how great War Games is. And you're completely wrong about this. And then this is how you do me, WCW. But it goes to what I was saying earlier. When you know what something is, but you don't know the proper way to execute it, the proper way to implement it. That's what we saw here. It was just bad piled upon bad, you know, from the fact that we had the three teams, from the fact that we had this stip where whoever got the pinfall got a title shot, which invalidates teams in the first place. The fact that we have just no respect for the rules. I think that's a great point Wade brings up, because in the earlier matches, you know, you brought up, John, how the refs are holding people back from getting in the ring. Like, there's a sense of believability in this crazy match, but we had none of that here. And then we get into the stuff with the Warrior and the Renegade and the dry ice and all of that stuff. And yeah, it was just bad. And it's crazy because, like you said, that segment the next night might be one of my favorite segments in the history of professional wrestling. And the fact that this company was able at that time to produce the worst and the best in wrestling, just it's frustrating. And obviously doing Keep It 2000 with Brian, we know where this path eventually leads to. But it's like, man, you had so many opportunities to really make something cool and creative and something that would resonate with the fans. But instead you gave us this, and this is no good.
We featured a quote of Dave Meltzer on the 1991 War Games match. So to even things out, let's get a quote from him on the 1998 match. It featured a main event so bad that it was even worse than people's imaginations would have been of the Jay Leno match going in. With the possible exception of the triple-decker cage match a few years back at an uncensored event, and perhaps some Andre the Giant matches toward the end of his career, this may have been the worst pay-per-view main event of all time. About 20 minutes of bad wrestling made worse by a finish that simply defied description. -4 stars.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to describe that finish.
Oh, my God.
So let's keep in mind here. Sid, 5-star War Games match.
Bret Hart. -4.
-4.
Oh, man.
That's one of the great trivia notes of all time when it comes to War Games history. An unbelievable takeaway from our 4 matches that we reviewed. And I am glad we had that 1991 one to contrast with Sid as a part of it. As we end things off, Nate, you kind of talked about the idea of the War Games at NXT. And I'm with you. I think that they will. I think you have tremendous talent in the match. I really hate the three teams, though. I'm really not a fan of it, so I'm going in skeptical with that setup, and I hope they prove me wrong.
Yeah, I am not a fan of the three-team setup because I think part of the thing that made War Games cool, in addition to just the concept and the look of the match, is that it had that Survivor Series thing that Wade was talking about where, you know, you kind of have these mismatched teams that are joining together to fight an insurmountable enemy. You know, like we get these super teams built to beat the Horsemen, or we get these super teams that are built to beat, you know, in the match in 89, I believe, we had the Samoan SWAT team and the Freebirds versus the Road Warriors, the Midnight Express, and Dr. Death. Like, and that you didn't get those combinations every week. And I think that was part of the appeal. So I have faith in NXT based on their track record with providing compelling storylines and intriguing matchups. But the three-team thing does give me a little bit of a pause to worry. But it can't be any worse than 98. I think that's the motto we should all be going into NXT War Games with. At the very worst, it can't be any worse than 98.
That's true. So maybe they should really push this 98 match over the next month and set everyone's expectation level at one where it can't possibly underwhelm people.
I don't feel like it's been all that long since we've seen a man spray dry ice into a cage only and appear in said cage to end a match. So I don't know. I don't know if our expectations should really be too high for this one.
I would really like if NXT over the next month would not airing the matches on TV on the NXT program, but showing highlights.
Yeah.
I think that would really build up the match because you have a whole generation of fans that they did not grow up with the NWA matches. And War Games, it's going to hold a special place for people, but others it won't. And I think it was something that as much as TNA tried with the Lethal Lockdown match, it was kind of their own spin on it. And there were some very good Lethal Lockdown matches. But WWE, when you have this library at your disposal, I would inject that into your program and get people really amped up by showing highlights of some of the classic War Games matches.
To have somebody like a Dustin Runnels, you know, or Ric Flair or Sting,
Sid.
Even Sid, whoever's on your staff.
To bring in Sid for a sit down.
Yeah, a sit down. Yes. To talk.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry.
That's amazing.
But just, yeah, totally to talk about the concept, to talk about why this is, aside from the visual, why I think it's a concept that people should really be excited about. Hopefully we provided a bit of that to our audience.
Yeah, to me, that would definitely be a smart thing, particularly, you know, you talk about guys that are on the roster or employed by the company that went through these things. Like, just looking at that 92 match where you got Sting, you got Dustin Rhodes, you got Ricky Steamboat, you got, you know, Steve Austin in the match. You know, I think that there's a way you can connect the best of the War Games and kind of leave the shadier or less effective matches back in the past, but highlight what made the War Games so good and bring it to this new generation.
If there's one complaint I will say about our own review, I think the skip from 91 to 98, there was a definite stop-off point along the way there for 1995, where we have Hogan, Savage, Luger, and Sting taking on Kamala, the Zodiac, the Shark, and Ming.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Like, that is one that just sounds way too good to be true. And I have probably seen that match, but it has been years and years and years since.
We got to do a part two of this review.
Well, we can always do that. I guess, Wei, what were you thinking of reviewing next?
Oh, yeah. I didn't really have any thoughts.
Well, you know what? We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back, and I feel I'm going to be all by myself doing feedback. So I will have an event that we are going to announce for our next review at that point. So stay patient on that. Nate, I do want to thank you, though, for hopping on and joining us. It's not often we get to do a show, the three of us, anymore. Although I hear the rumors we might be doing another show in the near future with you guys. So we
will. Yes, you never know, brother. Crossovers are big now, and I appreciate you and Wade for having me on this week to talk about War Games. Like, it's something that gets a bad rap, and at times I think it's justified, as we discussed that 98 match, but War Games to me, and this might be a crazy way to end things off, and Wake can give me a thumbs up or thumbs down on this, given his knowledge of hip hop, but War Games is like Eminem. Like those first four or five albums, bangers, classics. And then once you get like sober Eminem, the quality kind of dips a bit and it's not the same. It's not the same. And so I think once we get to like 92, 93, like, you can kind of skip War Games, but we will. And I guess this is a tease, John Pollock. Brian and I will be talking about future War Games in the year 2000 because, yes, Vince Russo decided to bring that back.
And totally change up the gimmick. So it's kind of a loose affiliation to the War Games chronology. But that is right. We will find out next month if the WWE presents a War Games that is very much a comeback, much like Eminem in a parking garage sharing his political viewpoints. So we will see. It could be a big return for both acts in 2017. So you can give Nate a follow at N8, M-O-Z-A-I-K. Way is here. Well, pretty much every week. So you can always follow him at Way0937. We'll take a break, and then I'm coming back with feedback.
They're building a dome of steel in Atlanta, a cage to enclose the match beyond the War Games. Witness the might of giants when the dreaded four horsemen clash with the force of the superpowers. 10 men will enter, only 5 will leave. In 2 rings back to back, it's 1-on-1, then 2-on-1. A flip of the coin decides which team dominates. Finally, the full battle is joined. The four horsemen and the superpowers collide. Submission or surrender will decide the victors in the match beyond the War Games. Be there when they drop the dome. Saturday, July the 4th in Atlanta. The War Games.
All right, John Pollock back with you. Wei Ting and Nate Milton have taken off. They have left me alone. They had enough of me for this show. So we are going to go through your feedback here, which you can always leave at lawradio.proboards.com for all of our shows. And we start off with Christian, who writes in terms of a match idea, this is one of the greatest creations there has ever been in wrestling. It's visually different with the two rings being surrounded by a cage, and it's one of the easiest booked matches as you start with the faces starting off strong, heels get heat when they get the advantage, and you switch back until everyone is in. It's a simple recipe that you shouldn't alter too much, as the 98 match shows, and I find it strange that WWE are doing it with 3 teams of 3 for their War Games and not sticking with the traditional setting. Now, personally, I'm like many who feel that War Games is a little overrated as a match. It has produced some absolute classics, but you can't get invested until the last man is in, as you know it can't end until then. It's also a very crowded match, even with the two rings. I'm interested in how NXT handles this match, and you do have some really good talent in there that can make it great. Yeah, all fair points there. I'll say it really does hit you, though, watching especially those Great American Bash ones right at the beginning, where different context, different time period, but man, that crowd, they could care less. They could not care less about the fact that not all the participants were yet in the ring. And it was just the violence was the big sell for all of the audience that was there to watch it. And I think you can structure a match in such a way that you can still engage your audience. And it's very short amounts of time. I mean, when you're talking about that big 5-minute period and then it's every 2, I mean, you still do have the mystery of who's coming in next, and that, I don't know, if done right, it's not as big of a detriment to the match. It's all in how it's paced and the guys you have involved. And I think that it will be a really well laid out match for Houston later on next month. Next up, McWhalen. The War Games was the best gimmick match in the history of WCW. I still think the promo packages of old... the promo packages of old hyping the match. I will imagine he remembers them. While I did not watch the network, I own the War Games Blu-ray that WWE released a few years ago. It was great to watch the classic matches of old, except for the 98 match. That was bad. Sid nearly breaking Pillman's neck with the powerbomb was and is still one of the most cringe-inducing moves I have ever seen. Seeing the rampant use of the flapjack, which was the lamest weapon ever used in my opinion during the match, as well as Warrior injuring himself, the match was just a cluster to watch. I don't know if the 98 match was the worst of the War Games 2000 or 2000's Nitro version. Both were awful. Look forward to seeing how the gang from NXT pulls off their showing. Well, the expectations are certainly high for TakeOver. That seems to be the general feel going into it. And I think we
I think that it will be a pretty good match with a hot crowd in Houston. I think they have a lot going for them. Yeah, I guess that can be your toss up is what, whether you look at the 2000 version they did on Nitro or 98, those would be your contenders for the worst war games. All right. Alexander from Portland. I know wrestling had a completely different style back in the 80s and 90s, but I just could not get into the wrestling for the first three matches. It's not like there was anything bad, but because I did not grow up watching the style of wrestling, I found it hard to buy into. The first match had poor audio quality and the closed captioning was unhelpful, so I couldn't get a story for this match from the announcers. The ending came out of nowhere, and guys continued to fight after the bell had rung. The second one had the bell ring, but the crowd literally did not react until they were told who won. With no referee to watch the action happening, with eight guys crammed into two rings, how do you figure out who to focus on? The third match was good, but yet again, there was just so much going on that I felt like I was missing some. With these first three matches, I also could not buy into them until the match beyond. Before then, it's just guys aimlessly beating up one another. Call me crazy, but for me, the fourth War Games match was the most enjoyable. Okay, I will call you crazy, Alexander. The match beyond stipulation was removed, so I was able to buy into all of the action. A referee was added, so I felt more focused with what to pay attention to. While I knew that this match wouldn't end until everyone got into the match, just having that option available was appreciated. Not that this match was great, almost everyone in it was shit. The first two guys in the ring could go, but it seemed like each subsequent person who entered the match was worse than the last. Not complaining about that, I'd much rather see less Nash and Hogan and Warrior than more of them. I was curious about the winner getting a mandatory title match. The way it was phrased made it sound like a title match was to be avoided. Fun note, the trapdoor that the Warrior used in the match leads to injuries to Davey Boy Smith. Yeah, well, that is not a fun note at all, the injuries that it caused. As a bonus, I watched the Hulkamaniacs versus the Dungeon of Doom, which is one of the most lopsided multi-man matches in pro wrestling. Hogan, Savage, Luger, and Sting against Kamala, Brutus Beefcake as Zodiac, John Tenta playing the Shark, and Ming. Never before have I seen Hogan win a match by submission. I'm sure it was a much more even matchup at the time, but I found it laughable seeing the Dungeon of Doom getting offense on any of the Hulkamaniacs. Overall, I think this gimmick match is mediocre. Typically, when there are multi-man matches in WWE, some guys are kept out of the ring while action is in the ring and focuses on two or three people. However, with this gimmick, you can't do that. There's no action ring and no rest ring. Even with the Royal Rumbles, when there are so many guys in the ring, action is well focused. The first three matches weren't, and the fourth just sucked. I'm not terribly excited to see the forthcoming War Games, but I have faith in NXT that I'll enjoy it more than the five I watched. Thank you both for providing the opportunity to watch these matches. Is there any other gimmick match from WCW you'd like to see WWE bring back? I mean, outside of a War Games match, I mean, there aren't too many gimmick matches that you naturally associate with WCW. I mean, there's the three-ring battle royal that I never liked. There was never a good version of that battle royal, and I don't need to see that at all. I think War Games is kind of the one you're going to see. Now, I know people are going to throw out a million gimmick matches they introduced in 1999 and 2000. No, I don't want to see the return of the Block. I don't want to see the Steiner Asylum come back. I mean, they had a lot of awful ideas. They had forklift matches. They had every kind of match. But no, none come to mind that I feel I need to see brought back. And finally, Jesse from the Six. Good choice of review this week. Very interesting. Maybe it's a case of having to have been watching the NWA in the 80s or WCW in the 90s to really appreciate the War Games, but I wasn't blown away. I have a few questions, which may have already been asked. Whose creation was War Games? Was it Dusty's? Yes, Dusty was booking at the time that they introduced the concept in 87, so he deserves the credit for introducing this match in 87. Why did they need two rings? It seems to me that while it would have been crowded, you could have fit 8 to 10 guys in one ring. I don't like the aesthetics of that, of having everyone in the ring at once. I think that would have been way too cluttered. You see that even now when they have, I mean, even when you're talking about a Money in the Bank match, it's not like you have all the guys in the ring at once. Everyone is spread out. They're on the floor, and that becomes a chore to shoot. And the two rings, that was part of the kind of idea that spawned this, is that visually it was something different, having a second ring there, which I don't think was a minus on this concept at all. I think that the visual stood out for people a lot. And he asks, what were these first Great American Bash shows for? They can't be just house shows because they were filmed and had commentary, but why was the commentary on the first match mixed so low? Were these aired on Turner at some point? This was the Great American Bash tour, and yes, they shot these and would eventually release them on home video. And yeah, the first one was obviously done in a studio afterwards, where the second one looks to be live commentary. So that's that. This was very much directed, though, as a live event to go attend, like a ramped up house show that they would film and later release. But these were not like pay-per-views or airing as televised specials that night or anything like that. And Jesse finishes off, "My biggest problem with War Games is the submission ending. In almost every match, the live crowd could not tell where the finish came from. Seems a pin would have been easier to spot. And also, as John has pointed out, the match only being able to end after everybody entered takes away from the drama. Oddly enough, many of these problems were fixed with the 98 version, but then they made up a whole bunch of new warrior-sized problems. All that said, it was fun looking back on these old shows, and the 91 match was genuinely good. It was also fun to see how over Nikita Koloff was in 87 and the Wolfpack were in 98. Okay, thank you guys for all your feedback. Different opinions of the War Games matches. I mean, I love those 87 matches. I thought they were tremendous. The 91 version stands out a lot, and we even put a poll out on our Twitter feed at Law Radio, and the consensus was 92, I think, was the majority of everyone's favorite, 98 the least favorite, and then 91 is probably a close second for a lot of people. Those were the two, 91 and 92, that if you're going to isolate two to go back and watch, those would be the ones I'd recommend. But I'd also check out one of the 87 matches just for the crowd heat, which was incredible. And all the guys worked super hard, and it was a rarity to see, first of all, a cage match, and then with all the stars in one match together with a unique concept. You had the blood. I mean, it was just it was a gimmick match that just clicked from day one, and they were able to do it quite a lot. You can go look up all the history of the War Games matches of how much they came back with that match in all the different cities as well. So Wei and I are going to be back in 2 weeks' time. That will be on Friday, November the 3rd. And we're planning our shows for November. So I think that this one is the only chance we're going to get this year to do a Survivor Series review. And I had to go back and look at all the Survivor Series we have reviewed. And we have reviewed a lot of them. So I have randomly chosen to go back 12 years to review the 2005 Survivor Series. This was a tough show because it happened right after Eddie Guerrero's death, his unfortunate passing earlier that month. And then the whole crew had to go on the European tour in November and then come back and do this pay-per-view. So it was right in the midst of all of that that was going on. It's one of the few Survivor Series we have not reviewed. So that is the review we are going to do for Friday, November the 3rd. We'll have a feedback thread up and chatting the Survivor Series from 2005 on our next show. So thank you to Wei Ting. Thank you to Nate Milton. We're going to be back. All of our regular shows are up at liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling today on iTunes and leave us that so desirable 5-star review. We appreciate anyone that leaves said reviews on iTunes. It very much helps us with just the promotion of the show, shooting us up those rankings, and then even more people will find the show. All right, that is it for me. Thank you for listening to Review Away, and we'll chat with you next time.
Keep in mind, Cincinnati, you are going to have the distinct privilege of being involved in the most violent sport in the world. It's the American Bash, and it's the War Games. The double cage over two rings. 5 guys on each team. It's blood, it's guts, it's violence at an all-time high. And you know what it is? It's to the victor goes everything you want in this world. How about it, Big Bear?
You know, I'll tell you what, when I used to be over on the other side watching what was going on up here, I used to get butterflies. I used to talk to the Road Warriors and Sting and Luger, and they always used to say, golly, guys, what are we going to do tonight? Well, I'll tell you what, when I'm on this side looking over there at y'all, I don't have butterflies because we all know for sure exactly what's going to happen. Horseman style, it's going to be done in this cage, and I guarantee you there's going to be some people hurting and crying and bleeding over there. Isn't that right,
Double A?
Double A. Come on up here. Come on. Spread out.
There is never a question of what we're going to do. when you're over there wondering what you were going to do, we're walking around laughing, giggling, finding out what our company's going to be from the evening. Because when you are what they say you are, the dirtiest players in the game, what we do is come natural inside a cage.